All right, we're ready to start with the class.
Yes.
It's just after the top of the hour. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1, Chapter 7, Wireless. Oh, we just love wireless because wireless is fun. It's one of the chapters I actually loved as a student. So I'm going to try and make it as equally as good for you guys too, if I can. How are you going, magic students?
Great.
Great, Pat. Oh,
pretty well.
One of you, pretty well, yeah. I know you're going well. And Narissa's well. She's up just before the recording came on. We were canvassing her about being up so early.
Yep, we're here.
And just for anyone in listener land, we were also talking, and Marshall, Scott, Pat, and Kim have all agreed that we should meet on Easter Thursday at North American time, or Good Friday for Narissa and I, and here in Melbourne, Australia. So we'll go straight through because that will be Chapter 9. So we've got three more meetings to go. This is Chapter 7, the wireless chapter. Next week is Chapter 8, which is security. And Chapter 9, troubleshooting, and the end of the presented sessions. Now, the course is still open until the end of June or the end of July. I'm not sure what Ian put it down as when they set them up back in January, but I'll check and see if don't feel that because the lectures are over that you've got to go and rush and do all your worksheets and get your exams in, and if you don't, the world will end. No, you can breathe easy. Okay, are there any questions about the lecture for those who have been ambitious enough to read ahead, or any questions about the material already covered in the course? Evidently not. Good. Okay, let's go. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Melbourne. Let's hope it's nice where you are too. Okay, now with wireless, it's not? Oh, what's it like? Shocking?
Oh, I'd say it's about 40 degrees, debating about raining. And they're using the four-letter word for tomorrow.
Oh, dear. All right, it's not good. All right, well, wireless seems to want to work through all this sort of weather anyway, so... All right, so everyone wants to stay connected to the network wherever they are, even if they happen to be walking up the shops talking to people on Skype. Yes, Kim and I have done that before. I've even taken my auntie on a train. I think I took Jackie on a train once, and all that sort of stuff just by using wireless technology from here to the cellular network on the Triple E. We use wireless technology for our mobile phones, and it's the same network that you often get wireless internet on. But there's also Wi-Fi, which is what we get in the home, and often some people who are not networky people might get it confused. So what network connection, internet connection have you got? And then they'll say, oh, I've got wireless. Anyway, what sort of wireless? Let's have a look. At the end of this chapter, you're going to be able to describe a heap of things. And they are. Describe wireless technology. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Describe various components of a wireless LAN. Describe wireless security issues and a migration strategy. Oh, that's interesting. And configure a wireless access point and wireless client. Now, I know Kim can do it. Kim can do that. She's done hers. And we'll see how the other people get on. 7.11. Okay, in addition to the wide network, which is what we've done a lot of discussion on, particularly with our bits on the wire in Chapter 3 and all that sort of stuff, there is wireless technologies. Wireless technologies use electromagnetic waves to carry information through the ether. Electromagnetic wave is the same medium that carries, you know, these radio station signals through the air. Now, who's connecting and who's not? Let's see who's on. Here comes Terry Mack. Ah, hello, Terry Mack from the other class.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi,
all
Terry.
The way down from the Rock and Roll Club. Here she is. I thought she'd come along. I threw an invite out to her last night before we went to bed.
It's pretty cold here today and the wind's pretty wild, so we're really rocking and rolling and shaking and whatever. Yep.
All right. There you go. Let's hear it for Christchurch. All right. Not forgetting the serious side of that statement, of course. We don't just want to make light of things here. Anyway. Okay, so this is the electromagnetic wave which carries, you know, radio signals through the air. In other words, you listen to your favourite radio station like CHML and Hamilton's News Talk Leader or in Melbourne 3RW. It's all transmitted on those two stations, actually on AM, medium wave. And we have our noisy, you know, give me the cash FM stations up on 100 megahertz, etc. They're all electromagnetic radiation and all going through the air, as is mobile phones, etc., etc. It's very cluttered these days. The electromagnetic spectrum is what we refer to it as, and that's why some people often say, oh god, there's so much interference from DC to light, because, you know, often if you get, you know, noisy AM transmissions or noise all over the band, or somebody starts up a power drill next door and interferes with your TV, we often say, ooh, there's so much interference right across the electromagnetic radio spectrum. Okay, this includes radio and television broadcasts, like I've just said, radiation, visible light and gamma rays. And what else have they got here in the notes? Yep, visible lights on the electromagnetic spectrum. X-rays, gamma rays. Each of these have specific range of wavelengths. Yes, now, I'll see if I can quantify the next bit into words, but generally speaking, the shorter the wavelength, the higher the frequency that wave actually is. And I used to know the formula for working it out too when I was a CB lout in my misspent youth, let's say. Some types of electromagnetic waves are not suitable for carrying data. Now, certain areas of the spectrum have been set aside for public use, and we'll discuss more of those as the lecture goes by. But there is infrared radio, infrared communications, which is a line of sight, and of course RF, which is a lot more reliable, because RF can go through walls. Yes, you can set up your wireless access point in the office and still have your laptop computer sitting on the sofa in the living room. How about that? Whereas you couldn't do that with infrared because it's line of sight. Okay. The major sections of the electromagnetic spectrum are listed below. There are gamma rays, which is on average 10 to the 14th. 10 to the minus 14th, actually. Well, I don't know why they just didn't give actually what the size is in like nanometers or something, which is 10 to the 14th, 10 to the minus 12th. X-rays, which is equals 10 to the minus 12 to 10 to the minus 10 meters. Ultraviolet rays is 10 to the minus 10 to 10 to 10 to the minus 8 meters. Visible light is 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 6 meters. And optical spectrum colors. Now, this is visible light that we can see. Now, we're coming lower down. So now as we come lower in frequency, we go longer in wavelength, actually. There you go, as I just said before. Okay, from visible light, we see violet. Now, Nerissa, can you see violet?
In what context?
Any.
Well, violet's like purple, isn't it?
It is. I was just remembering back to the day when we first met, when we were playing with orange and green lights, and maybe a blue one, and perhaps even a red one as well, with the saucepan lids.
Purple's my favourite colour, so, yes, I can see purple or violet. I wasn't sure, you know, whether you meant like in the rainbow or a prism or what you
actually mean. Yeah, a rainbow, prism, yep. Yeah, well, I know purple's your favourite colour. You've got ultraviolet, which some of that you can't see. But you can often find that some contact lenses, and I've got a contact lens here, and my old acrylic glasses used to filter out the very, very top end of violet. I could always see the filtering in them, and you'd put your glasses on, and you'd see, like, you go into these places, and like some places have these fluorescent, like the black light that you have in the bank, for example, and it would fluoresce the chemicals on a white piece of paper, for example. They have them in nightclubs and stuff too, and you'd walk in with a white t-shirt on or something, and they'd fluoresce the white in the clothing, and so you get the brighter than bright, and they put some of that fluorescing powder in soap powder and stuff so that it brings your clothes up a bit whiter. And you put your glasses on and everything would go really, really dark because it would filter off the top end.
I've seen that beautiful bright whitey purple colour like in a nightclub.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's violet or ultraviolet, probably low-frequency ultraviolet. Then we come down to blues, into greens, into yellows, into orange and red, and infrared rays. And that's what remote controls use. As I said, infrared it's a low-frequency light, so it's not going to get through walls. It will get through glass, but it won't get through walls, which means that for people with guide dogs out there who want to flick channels on their TV set, they could have trouble if the guide dog gets in the way of the beam between the remote control and the telly. Saying here it's wavelength minus 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 4 meters there. I think they're referring to infrared there. Radar is a little bit lower than visible light or infrared. That's radar, as in like what the aeroplanes use. They're telling us there that wavelength is around about 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 2. See, I hope you don't have to remember this. I'm pretty sure you don't for the test. Now it tells us about TV and FM radio. In my opinion, that's to skip the big, huge chunk of the spectrum because I'm not sure where radar is. I wish it would give it to me in frequencies because I can actually relate to frequencies better. Marshall, would you happen to know what frequency radar is on?
I think it's upwards in the 10 gigahertz region, but don't quote me.
No.
It's where microwave ovens are.
Yeah, and they can actually interfere down at 2 gigs too, because coming down towards 2 gigs, there is ESM band, and we'll discuss the ESM band a bit later on. 5 gigs and 2 gigs, it's where you see your mobile phone, not mobile phones, your handheld phones, your digital cordless phones, rather. Then you've got the ESM band, the industrial scientific and medical band that comes up, which is what we're going to talk about, which is where our integrated services routers are and all that sort of stuff. And then you come down through the mobile phones, you got your 1.8 gig, 1.9 gig, I think America, I can't remember where they are at the moment, you'd probably know, Marshall. 800 and 900 meg mobile phones bands. My particular handset's a tri-band handset, so it works on all three bands, so I was able to use it when I came over to see Jackie last year, which was rather handy. TV and FM radio, well, yep, they're wavelength equals 1 meter. Geez, that's general. I'm sorry, I don't like it. It's actually, there are wavelengths of TV broadcasts that are 2 meters, because I know that for a fact, having been an old radio ham. You in Australia, our FM broadcast band is 88 to 108 megahertz, as I believe it is in America. And you've got TV stations either side of that. You've got some, our old Channel 2, analog Channel 2, was on 69 megs, 69.750 to be precise. Good grief, it's all coming back to me. Ugh, that's scary. And we had television stations above it, on 188 megahertz. We had TV stations on 200 megahertz. I suppose they're saying pretty general, because 2 meters was about 150 megs, I think, a bit more than that, whatever it was. So, they're being a bit general here. Wavelength equals 10 to the power of 2 meters. Short wave, okay. Short wave, yeah, well, that's anything, I used to say anything that was short wave was between 3 megahertz and 30 megs. That's where we'd all get on our short wave radios at night time, listen to the BBC World Service when we were younger, and Radio Moscow. Radio Moscow had bigger American accents than the Americans.
Really?
Oh, it was quite funny listening to Radio Moscow. You'd be listening, life in the Soviet Union. Workers, it's the workers' paradise. No one ever need fear of losing their job. And everyone's got the right to medical care. And you'd hear the Americans a few megahertz up, hammering away at the Soviets. This is back in the Cold War days, hammering away at the Ruskies, going on about how life was so good in America. Geez, it was fun. Those bands, of course, Narissa will remember, with Uncle Peter and a few other uncles, that we had ham radios in the shack out the back. Remember that, Narissa?
I remember Peter's, yes.
And they'd be all on the shortwave bands. 80 metres is, 80 metres, of course, is, going back to my memory, 3.6 gigs to be precise, roughly thereabouts. 40 metres, that was around about 7 megs. What did I say, 80 metres? 3.6 megs, not gigs. 40 metres was around about 7 megs, give or take. 20 metres was around about 14 megs. Yeah, CQ20, CQ20 metres. This is VK3, AVI calling CQ20, CQ20. Yes, we had the ham radio club at school. And 10 metres was 28 megs. And for all the people who failed their radio exam, 11 metres was CB, 27 megs. So, we're coming down now, and then we come into radio, AM radio, which is roughly 500 kilohertz up to about 1.6 megahertz, or 1600 kilohertz, which is your AM broadcast band. And as Marshall and Pat and Kim will tell you, because Canada is the same as America, they're all channelized at 10 kilohertz steps over there, which is why you hear AM 900 CHML, whereas they're channelized at 9 kilohertz steps here in Australia, which means you need to have a slight, like, they're on the same band, but the radio station's actually a little bit closer together here in Australia. There you go. So that all happens on good old AM, or ancient mode, as we used to say. It stands for amplitude modulation. We won't talk about how the signal's modulated, because it's a little bit outside of this course, but it's got to do with the more level in the signal, the more amplitude on the audio, the varies the amplitude of the AM wave. So there you go. So we've come down to AM, down to about 500 kilohertz. And it says here, wavelength equals 10 to the power of 4 meters. Why don't we just simply give it out as what it was? So you're talking around about 180 metres or longer. It doesn't talk here about long wave. The BBC, the British used to use long wave, which is lower than the AM broadcast band. And Yeah, I think they still are, actually, because long wave will actually travel across the sea. The reason why we use these different frequencies is because the waves propagate differently. The lower the wavelength, the more likelihood, the longer the wavelength or lower the frequency, the wave will follow the curvature of the Earth a lot more, whereas some frequencies bounce off the ionosphere, which is how short wave works, which is why here in Australia could hear broadcasts from the continent of Europe and the North Americas and stuff, because they're bouncing their signals off the ionosphere. And then FM, which is VHF, actually, which is what we used to call it, 30 megs to 300 megs, the FM broadcast band, and most of the television here in Australia, unless you're in the country, is VHF. That was more line of sight, and the higher the frequency, the more line of sight you get, which is important to know because even though radio waves can travel through walls, by the time you're getting up to the ISM band, where our routers and bits and pieces are, we're going to be talking about in this lesson, it is line of sight. So, you know, don't go putting your integrated services router under the desk or in a cupboard somewhere and expecting to get as good a results as what you might if you put it up on a reasonably high point on your desk or, you know, on a reasonably good high vantage point in the house. Okay, any questions so far?
I don't understand all that talk about minus 10 and however they described before about the meter.
Neither do I. It's the greatest load of crap. It's the greatest load of crap. And when I was taught radio theory back in the 80s, we didn't do that at all. We just learned it properly. So there you go. So forget the lot because it's garbage. Sorry, Cisco. How they didn't teach radio theory the way we did it was a hell of a lot easier to understand. I don't know. There you go. So don't worry about it. Go on.
It's basically frequency times wavelength is always equal to the speed of light. So technical, but, you know, so wavelength is equal to C divided by the speed of light divided by F, if I remember right.
Yeah, and there was another formula that would give you the wavelength times the wasn't there one that gives you the wavelength divided by the frequency, wavelength times the frequency, something would give you the speed of light, was it? I can't remember now. God, it's been a while, but I know we didn't have to do powers or anything when I did it.
I don't know why they gave it in wavelength.
Oh, look, I don't know why they didn't give it in wavelength. And we used to just go, look, you know, anything that was long wave was anything below about 300 kilohertz, I think. Medium wave is 300 or 500 kilohertz up to 3 megahertz. Short wave was 3 megahertz up to 30 megahertz. VHF was 30 megahertz to 300 megahertz. UHF was 300 megahertz to 3 gigs. And then there was SHF and EHF. I can't remember which was super high frequency and extremely high frequency. I remember learning those as a kid at school. And you just used to learn it at 300 megs, and it was easy. You know, it was, you know, every time you got a 300 something, a 3, you'd just go up to the next group. No, the way they've done it here, I'm not particularly impressed. That's why I expanded it out, actually. I talked about, you know, FM broadcast here in Australia and, you know, UHF and that sort of stuff. I've actually expanded it out a bit more than the description that's in the notes. You don't particularly have to know it, all of it, because we don't want to digress. We actually want to get into... Yeah, you know, we're at 24 minutes past the hour here, so we better get a wriggle on. It's all very well for me to prove what a goose I was in the 80s messing around on radio, but it does digress a bit. Any questions? All right, infrared, which it talks about here, is relatively low energy and low energy and cannot penetrate through walls. It's like visible light. So what you can see is what you're going to get. I used to lie in bed with my CD player and beam the remote control for it and beam the signal off the wall, and that used to be pretty cool because it will reflect off, you know, walls as light does. You can get an infrared or IRDA, an infrared direct access port on a computer. I played with a USB one some years ago and got horribly disgusted when it wouldn't work properly, and really haven't really given up on it. It's a bad technology, I really think it is. Particularly, it's good enough for little pulses of data like pulses to turn your TV set off, but I don't think it's any good if you want to put, you know, high streams of data through it. think it's just a waste of time messing around with it, to be blunt. It's a one-to-one connection. It says here that it's used for wireless keyboards and wireless mice and remote controls. I've just said that, but I wouldn't even consider using an IR keyboard or mouse. It's generally used for shortwave, and this is important, shortwave and line-of-sight devices. Now, I have seen questions in the Cisco exam about all this. It may be in the IT exams for those of you doing IT, and it could even be in this chapter. Had I had a little more time to prepare this morning, I would have had a look at the exam. So just bear that in mind. I have seen questions of just get used to the term line of sight. Actually, there was a question, I think, when I was a student. There were two possible right answers, and I think they were looking for the more line of sight type answer. It's short range. It says here it is possible to reflect the IR signal off objects. As I said, I used to lie in bed playing with my CD player by reflecting it off the wall. For greater ranges, higher frequencies of electromagnetic waves are required. Yeah, okay. RF or radio frequency. RF waves can penetrate through walls, as I said before. Okay, certain areas of the radio spectrum have been set aside for unlicensed devices such as integrated services, routers and that sort of stuff, cordless phones and all that sort of stuff. Wireless LANs it's got here. Yeah, cordless phones and computer peripherals. This includes the 900 megahertz frequency range, the 2.4 gigahertz frequency range, and the 500 gigahertz frequency range. These ranges are known as, this is important, as the industrial, scientific, and medical band. In other words, ISM, ISM. So the industrial, scientific, medical band is what I was referring to before, and that's all unlicensed. And that's why, guys, you might find that you might get a cordless headset for a computer like I did last year, and you might find it can actually be interfered with when somebody rings up on your cordless phone. Or your cordless phone, as I think happened with Yvonne Narissa not too long ago when she moved things around on her desk, was interfering with her wireless LAN. Because they're all up there, they're unlicensed, they're all over the place, and they can interfere with each other. Bluetooth is a technology that makes reuse of the 2.4 gigahertz band, which is also part of the ISM. Bluetooth is limited in the respect that it's short range, low energy, low speed, short range, but it can allow you to communicate with many devices at the same time. We're talking Bluetooth here. This one-to-many communications has made Bluetooth the favoured technology for many PC and their peripherals, and also printers. Hey, haven't heard much from you, Kimmy. How are you going?
Pretty well.
So all this radio junk making sense yet?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Good. I won't expect you to remember what frequency CHML is on, though. They only tell it to you every 5 minutes, but... no, it's all interesting radio. Comes down from... It's all on the same spectrum. Okay. There's the other technologies that make use of the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz band are the modern wireless technologies that conform to the IEEE 802 standards. 802.11 standards, actually, the wireless technologies that conform to the 802.11 standards. So we're going to look at some of these. They're not like Bluetooth technology in that they transmit it at a much higher power level, which gives them obviously a greater range. Now, they've got another list of stuff here that's going from the other way. Audio is very low. Well, that's lower than the electromagnetic band. Oh, well, it's part of the electromagnetic band, but it's vibrations audio, isn't it? It's not really. It's very low. It's low frequencies, like, you know, we're hearing in the range of lower than 100 hertz up to, depending on your age, anything up to 15 kilohertz. I used to be able to hear up to 20 kilohertz. So the older you get, the lower that figure at the top end comes down, of course. So you've got audio extremely very low, AM, which I said before, which is your, you know, 500 kilohertz to, you know, 1.6 meg band, which is low. Medium to high shortwave radio, we just call it shortwave in our days. FM, you know, music stations, brain dead people. They're 88 to 108 megahertz. It says, what's it say here? Medium FM broadcast. Well, they just simply call it VH bloody F and be done with it. Do they still use those terms in America, Marshall? VHF, UHF, etc.?
The hams do.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know anyone else who do these. We used to, that's how I was brought up. It's all HF, VHF, UHF, SHF, medium wave, short wave, etc. Some people used to say. Very high television is, good grief, I'll just say UHF. In Australia, our terrestrial television stations in the country are all on UHF. If you go to my friend Amy's place up in Ballarat, in the major cities, they tend to still be on VHF, which is your 200 megs, etc. Very high to ultra high. Yeah, this is not the way we were brought up. I'm sorry, Cisco. Very high frequency was VHF. They're saying ultra high. Well, yeah, UHF. It's your 840 megahertz band. That's all right. Cellular phones, which is part of the bands. Ultra high cordless phones. Ultra high end PCs at 930 megs. Interesting. Well, let's just stick with the way we know it. IEEE 802.11b, G and N, all that junk. Let's just do this properly. And are on the ISM band at 2.4 gigahertz, which in my opinion when I was growing up was, I think, the top end of UHF, I think. So there you go. Yeah, it says ultra high. I've actually got that one right. Good on them. Yeah, ultra high. Infrared wireless LAN spectrum, it says here. Visible in, I think somebody's described a diagram. There must have been a diagram here that I think the atoms must be describing at the high end of the spectrum. It could be what it is, because the people who have gone through here and done some of the picture descriptions have been very good, thank you. Okay, any questions at this point? I just love this chapter. I love wireless, it's good. All right, let's have a look at 7.2.1. Benefits and limitations of our wireless technology. Okay, one of the main advantages to wireless is to provide always on any time services. There's a wide area of points around this town known as hotspots, allow connectivity pretty much any time. And people can exchange emails and files, of course, because they can get access to the internet. Wireless technology is fairly easy and inexpensive to install. The cost of small business and home wireless devices continuously decreases, and that would be true. We get a lot more bang for our dollar now when we spend, you know, we have to replace an integrated services router or a wireless access point. Yet, despite the cost or the decreasing costs, the features and the standards of these devices have actually increased. The data rate has also increased, which enables better wireless connections, because when they have 802.11n, etc. When this course was written, it wasn't ratified, and we'll come to that in a minute. Wireless technologies enable networks to be easily expanded, and I think there might be a test alert on that. As I said, it's been 12 months since I've done the test, because that's when I qualified as an instructor in March or April last year. Jackie and I did it on the same night, actually. Got the same score, I might add, but different questions we got wrong. But nonetheless, we both turned out to be instructors, which is really cool. Another advantage is that new and visiting users can join the network quickly. Kim and I had somebody here yesterday. I offered them the access to my network. She could have joined it very easily had she wanted it. She later went on to use her own mobile cellular phone dongle thing, but she could have. I could have just given her the key for here. And WPA key for here, and she could have got on very easily if she wanted to, because I have a key here that I can give out to clients. Okay, some advantages. Easy connection for both, or mobility allows for easy connection for both stations and mobile devices. Scalability can be easily expanded. Flexibility provides anytime, anywhere connectivity. Equipment costs continues to fall as the technology matures, and I think, you know, since I've been messing around with it, the technology has definitely matured, far more reliable than what it used to be. It reduces installation time, so installation of a single piece of equipment can provide connectivity for a wide number of users, and a large number of users. Reliability in harsh environments, a la Nevada, or Utah, I mean. Sorry, Marshall, there you go. In windy Utah, you can have wireless there and it will still work. There you go. Despite the benefits and flexibility of wireless, there are some disadvantages. Before I read them out of the notes, can anyone tell me what some of the disadvantages of wireless might be, so I can actually clear my throat a bit?
Maybe not totally secure.
That's a good one. Narissa, well done. Any others?
It would be slower than Ethernet.
Yep, can be slower. Yep, great one. Kim, anything else?
Interference.
Another good one. Geez, these people are on the ball. You know this stuff. There you go. I think they're all here. Yep, it says wireless technology doesn't provide the speed or reliability as cable, which is what Kim mentioned. Network and data security, I think Narissa mentioned that. And somebody mentioned interference. I think it was also you, Narissa. Well done. They're the 3 points that actually Cisco has come up with. 7.1.3 types of wireless networks and their boundaries. Now, I seem to remember in one of the courses I did, either ITE Chapter 8, Kim, which you'll be doing next week, my dear, and this chapter, which is Chapter 7, had some questions of the limitations. So get your memory into memory mode gear. I know you don't like remembering these figures, but you're pretty good at studying. So here we go. Wireless networks are grouped into three major categories. Wireless personal area networks, WPANs. Wireless local area networks, or WLANs. And wireless wide area networks, WWANs. Okay, let's have a look at these WANs. Despite these distinct categories, it is still somewhat difficult to put limitations on these, but it's because wireless networks do not have precise boundaries. I mean, let's say Bluetooth, for example, has a range of 100 meters. Is that right? 100, no, that's not right. 10 meters, sorry. 802.11g has 100 meters. Well, let's say we'll have a look at 100. Yeah, let's actually do this. 100 meters for 802.11g. Kim has such a device, but I bet you she won't get 100 meters out of it. And the reason is because she lives in a basement apartment. So part of her house is underground. Therefore, we might get lucky. We could probably be on the front lawn of their place and probably get her wireless LAN, but I reckon the people upstairs would be getting more coverage than she will. Same, I can get halfway down my driveway here. In actual fact, I think since I put the new one in, I can get pretty much down to the front fence without it dropping out. I really need to do a field test, but one of the earlier ones I couldn't. But that's in one direction. I'm not necessarily going to get 100 metres in all directions. So the boundaries can be blurred. I'm sure when our new next door neighbour moved in here back in January, I noticed a degradation in my own wireless system. I was talking to Kim and Kylie about it one morning, and that would be, I would suppose, there was a new wireless network I could see when I was looking at wireless, you know, in my Windows, you know, wireless networks window when you're looking to join a new network. And there's always new ones coming on all the time. When I first moved in here, I was the only one who had one. And there was somebody new called the Belcom something or other. In other words, they hadn't configured it, and probably it was secure though, fortunately. We'll talk about that shortly. But I'd say that they were interfering with mine, so I had to put mine on a specific channel up the other end of the band, and I got all my wireless connectivity back. Actually, Kim will remember that. You remember me taking ages just to transfer a few gigs from the Vostra up to the network, huh?
Yeah, I remember that.
So, because the boundaries aren't, you know, and the units here are pretty close together, and you can see the other wireless networks around your area anyway, can't you?
Lots of them, they change.
They do. So, you'll probably find that they're probably getting better coverage because they're probably living, you know, they could have their router near a window or something, and they could probably get out a bit better. So, the boundaries aren't actually, you know, set in stone, because you're going to have things that interfere with it, things that block it, and that sort of stuff. And it says here the range of wireless transmissions can due to many factors, and I've probably just outlined a few specific ones here pertaining to Kim and myself. Susceptible to outside sources of interference, yes. If somebody starts off, you know, there's a building site with power tools next door, they could interfere with you, like they can interfere with the analog television. Fluctuations in temperature and humidity, and this is a good one because it interferes with most electromagnetic waves, often particularly with UHF and VHF. We used to notice that high humidity, we'd get less of a signal off Mount Dandenong for our TV and FM reception here in Melbourne. Obstacles within the wireless environment, which I mentioned both with here and at Kim's house. There's a WPAN, which is a personal area, wireless personal area network, and this is the smallest type of wireless network around because it uses Bluetooth. It's used to connect mice, keyboards, PDAs, etc., to computers, usually just for peripherals. So that would be good if you had a Bluetooth keyboard or something sitting on your desk, right near your computer. All of these devices are dedicated to a single host, the single host being the computer, using which usually is Bluetooth or infrared technology. There are some WPA in standards here. There's Bluetooth 2.0 EDR ... whatever this is, who wrote all this? The acronym is EDR, Enhanced Data Rate. Yeah, the EDR, Enhanced Data Rate, is probably the one that you want to use if you're going to be playing music into your Bluetooth headset. Less than 3 megabits per second, MBS per second. Range is short. Applications, peer-to-peer and device-to-device. There's WLANs. WLANs are used to extend the boundaries of the local wide network. In other words, we want to have a little bit more coverage than what's running around our office, around the skirting board, or if it's done in the walls, what's done with your Ethernet cabling. We want a bit more range, or we want to, you know, bring some people into their network, like some, you know, traveling sales staff and that sort of thing, who are coming in and out with laptops. So we'd set them up on wireless. The most common standards at the moment are the IEEE 802.11 G and N standards. Okay. This uses RF technology, and they all conform to these IEEE 802.11 standards. They allow many users to connect, of course, and you usually use an access point, although you can connect with an ad hoc network, which we'll discuss a bit further down, but most of the networks that we're familiar with and we're discussing in this course are actually infrastructure mode, which is through an access point. WLA in standards. IEEE, A, B, C, G, and N. Now, A is out by itself, but G is backward compatible with B, and N is backward compatible with G. There's Hyperland and Hyperland 2. I'm not really familiar with those. Speed to 1 to 540 megabits per second, megabytes. Mbps anyway, I'm not sure which one they're using here. Okay. Range is medium. Applications, home, small business and enterprise networks. WWLAN. These WWLANs provide you extreme coverage, or coverage over an extreme area. A good example of this is the cell phone network. These networks use technologies as, and I think Kim and who else is doing IT in this course? Pat might be with Grace's group. So Kylie's group's a little ahead. And they were doing laptops and portable devices the other week and discussing different types of cellular phones that are around. Some of these are code divisional multiple access, code division multiple access, or CDMA, and we see that used in the country a lot, in the rural areas. Global System for Mobiles, which is the European GSM standard developed by the Ericsson folks. What else is there here? These CDMA and GSM, and GSM, now we see that extended into 3G and that sort of stuff, third generation mobile phones and stuff, where we see the internet and, you know, streaming pictures and all that sort of stuff on it. These are all really governed by, governments, you know, regulatory organisations and that sort of stuff, and it's all relatively well planned out. Some WAN standards, WAN standards are GSM, GPRS, and CDMA, GPRS for the for some data going through it. Speeds can be 10 to 384 kbps. Range can be long. Applications, PDAs, mobile phones and cellular access. Any questions before we move on to 7.2? Evidently not. A number of standards have been developed so that these devices can all communicate. Some of the standards specify the part of the RF spectrum that's used, the data rate that's used, and how the information is actually transmitted. The main organisation responsible for this is the IEEE, or the institution, or the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. Now, there are some amendments to the IEEE 802.11 standards, which govern what we're doing here with our personal computers, and they are. Okay, let's have a look at some of these amendments to the IEEE 811 standard. Is IEEE 802, that's how you usually say it actually, 802.11a, 802.11 actually is the way we say it, 802.11, 802.11, however you want to express it, but 802.11a, 802.11b, 802.11g, and 802.11n. Now it says here in the notes, as of the time of this writing, the 802.11n standard wasn't yet ratified, but it had been developed and had been going through its later stages of ratification and testing. Since then, it's now been ratified, and you'll find many PCs and access points now capable of supporting 802.11n. In actual fact, when I bought my Triple E PC, it was still officially not ratified, but they had it in there anyway because they knew that they could do it. Collectively, these technologies are referred to as what, gang?
Wireless technologies?
Wi-Fi. Have you ever heard the expression Wi-Fi?
Oh, of course.
You know, we all grew up with Hi-Fi, high fidelity, and now we got Wi-Fi. There's another mob here known as the Wireless... The Wi-Fi Alliance, responsible for testing devices and compatibility from different manufacturers. There you go. This wireless alliance will check compatibility and conform and how these things conform. If this equipment meets the right standards, you'll see the Wi-Fi logo on a device. So once you see that logo on a device, you know that it meets the specific standards. Hello, Gypsy. You want something to eat, darling? Okay, and I was talking to Terry about logos and things the other night. Was I not, Terry?
Yeah, wireless symbols and logos.
Symbols and logos, I think we're talking
Bluetooth
about.
And little that's it.
Little transmission tower with waves coming out either side is the Wi-Fi logo, and you'll see that on various devices. Now, what have we got here? Here are the differences between the 802.11 standards, and some of these are in your test, gang, so listen up. Okay, 802.11a, it uses the 5.0 gigahertz spectrum, part of the band, the 5.0 gigahertz part of the radio frequency band, and it is not, I repeat, it is not compatible with the 4.2 gigahertz part of the spectrum. So this is why we don't say, oh, well, B is backward compatible with A. We only say N, G, and B are compatible. We don't say A's because poor old A is out there. It's even on a frequency that's twice that, or just over twice that of the 2.4 gig band. So there you go. They're not going to talk too well. Okay. This is relatively inexpensive to implement compared to other technologies. I haven't seen an 802.11a device around for yonks, to be blunt. I really haven't. It says here in the notes, increasingly difficult to find such devices because they're so old, and that was when this curriculum was written, which is now, what, 2 or 3 years old itself. 802.11b, here we go. 802.11b uses a 2.4 gigahertz spectrum, part of the spectrum. It actually has a maximum data rate of 11 megabits per second. Has a range of approximately 46 meters or 150 feet, depending on what country you're from, gang. 46 meters or 150 feet. And it says actually indoors, it goes down to 96 metres and 300 feet. So there you go. So it actually says this is the standard that Cisco are giving us here. 802.11g, and this is one of my favourites because it's where I really came into it all, set a number of these things up. 2.4 gigs again, so same frequency as B. Maximal data rate now increases to 54 megabits per second. So again, as Kim rightly said before, still slower than Ethernet. It's 100 megabits per second, so we're only at this point half the speed of, or just over half the speed of your standard good old Ethernet junk. Same range as the 802.11b standard, which is your 46 metres or 150 feet, and it is backward compatible with 802.11b. Okay, so 802.11g is backward compatible with 802.11b. Alright, so which means if you have your 802.11g computer and you go to someone's house that's only got a B router, you can still talk to it. Okay, on B, ISR. The newest standard is the 802.11n, which is what I'm now running here. Both my computers now have it, as does my access point. However, if I turn up at someone's house who's only got a G router, no problem because it's backward compatible, so we don't have to stress. Okay, again, it uses the 2.4 gigahertz part of the spectrum. It also says specify support for 5 gigahertz. So it can actually operate on both. Yep, so there you go. It can actually turn up on both frequencies, both bands of frequencies. It's a draft. At the time of this writing, it was draft. It extends the range and data throughput. It's backwards compatible with existing 802.11g, as I've just said, and B networks, actually. So there you go. So it's backward compatible with B. Draft standard also specifies the support for the 802.11a standard, which is why, because we can see our 5GB there. So it is supposed to be backward compatible with 802.11a. I've never tried it, naturally, but there again, that's what the standard tells us. Is approximately 33% of that of the 802.11b/n standard. Why the hell they just... Oh, so it's actually shorter. Yeah. Oh, it's actually a little bit shorter. I thought the range was longer. Oh, no. It says here the range is approximately 33% that of the 802.11g/b/g standard. So I'm a bit confused, I might admit. We might want to study up on that and just do a bit of Googling before you do your exams. Because as I said, the field test varies every time I walk down the driveway. Okay, there's a diagram here. Let's see who wrote this up and see if it makes sense that I can read it. Standard 802.11. Standard 802.11, the release date was 1997, so it goes back that far. Frequency 2.4 gigahertz, data rate 3 megabits per second, 2 megabits max. Maximum range, I beg your pardon, was undefined. Then we went to 802.11a, release date October 1999. Frequency 5 gigahertz, as we've just said, data rate 54 Mbps. Natural and maximum range 50 meters. Standard 802.11b turned up also in 1999. Frequency 2.4, so it sort of came out compatible with alongside the A. You've got a data rate of 11 Mbps, and you can get twice the distance out of it at 100 meters. Or it said further up 46 meters or something. But who's going to laugh at the extra four? Standard 802.11g, it first showed up in 2003. Actually, I remember when it did first show up. I remember Will getting into it at about that time, I think. But there was still a lot of B integrated services routers and B equipment around at that time. And I remember people installing B cards into their computers. 2.4 gigs, of course, as we've said, 54 Mbps and 100 meters again. It says here release date approved March 2007. I'm not sure of the exact date, but it was obviously something in the last few years anyway. Frequency 2.4 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz. Data rate max 540 Mbps. Yep, that adds up to me. Maximum range, there we go. Maximum range 250 meters. There you go. So what was I reading further up with this 33%? And they must have been trying to say 33% greater is what they were obviously trying to say before when they were using 33. So As I thought, 802.11n is got more of a range, and they would have had trouble trying to sell it if it was shorter, but they never know. But it is certainly a lot faster, and I like it. I'm enjoying having it. It says maximum range is value can vary widely. Well, that's fair enough. Okay, values may change, it says in the notes, because at the time the notes were written, it was in draft. 7.22 we're up to now, which is wireless LAN components. Any questions before we jump into that? All right, let's keep going, because I've probably mucked around a bit with the earlier part of the spectrum. Okay, you can have a wireless client or STA. Once the standard's adopted, it's important that all the components in your wireless network conform to it. So you can have a wireless client or STA, an access point, a wireless bridge, and an antenna. So let's have a look at these. A wireless client, or in other words, the laptop that we have sitting out on the dining room table, for example, is any host or device that can participate in a wireless LAN or a wireless access point. Most devices that can be connected to a traditional wired network can be connected to a LAN as long as it's got the necessary hardware. These devices can either be stationary or mobile, so we can walk around the house. And if Kim's was a bit more mobile and a bit easier to use, she could take us out when she cooks dinner. She said she's just going to turn us up very loud. She tells us. I have my wireless devices on my dining room table, and they float around the house a bit because Narissa, when they come over, talk to Kim on the link, and we play cards with Evon, and all that sort of stuff's done by, you guessed it, Wi-Fi. Okay, the term STAR, or STA, is short for station. Is it? Yeah. Somebody's chopped something out of the notes. Oh, no, STA is actually short for the word station, as in STATION. Good on them. I was expecting a three-letter acronym here. We love our three-letter acronyms in IT. We don't generally shorten words down to that. But anyway, apparently STA is a STAR, and I think I did see it in a test somewhere. Okay, examples of a STAR include laptops, PDAs, printers, projectors, and storage devices. And I can come up with another example too, and that is my internet wireless, the Sanjin that sits out in the living room, that Ian was good enough to read me the instructions for the night I got it, is also a wireless device. It also has an Ethernet port on the back of it so that it can communicate with the network. And it can actually get files off my server through UPnP or Samba, or Windows sharing, or it can dial up a number of internet stations. It actually sees the internet and pulls a particular website, and I can listen to a lot of radio stations on it, including Radio 1010 in Toronto. Can't see CHML on there though. And I have ABC Darwin and a few other things in there of interest, a couple of radio stations from New Zealand, one from near where Jackie lives that I like to listen to, etc. So it's a device that connects. Only a receiver, of course, doesn't sort of send much data back. Well, it sends a little bit of data back to authenticate into the network, of course, but that's about it. And obviously has to request stations and stuff, but that's about it. Okay, let me see. An access point. Now, this is the most important thing. An access point in our infrastructure networks controls communications between all of these devices. So, a good case, we'll use Kim. I love using you as an example, hun. I really do. She has a friend called Shannon, and she's over again. Hello, Shannon, if you're listening. We love you, Shannon. Okay, now, Shannon's back over, and Shannon is getting to use Kim's older PC, because since the last visit, Kim has a new computer. Isn't that wonderful? Now, they are talking on the wireless network. Now, she can share out a folder on one computer to the other, but they don't talk direct. All the communications between those two computers would have to occur at the permission and the discretion of the access point, which is built into her integrated services router. How's that? So, Narissa, if you had to, when you brought that laptop over here, for example, it didn't talk directly to my computers. It won't. It has to go through the access point. And obviously, it has to go through the access point, which we remember back from a few lessons ago is connected to one port on probably a five-port switch. Which of course means it's on the near side of our network. Does everyone remember Chapter 3? And then on the far side, of course, is the big, bad, nasty internet. So is this all making sense?
Yeah.
Kim?
Making sense.
Good-o. Nerissa?
Think so. When I'm more awake, it might make sense better.
All right. Well, you know that if you had two wireless computers connected to your WAN, they wouldn't talk directly. They have to go through the access point. That's a particularly good point to grasp in this lesson. How are you going, Pat? Okay, the access point will also control access between a wireless and a wired network. So anyway, anything that's going from your computer will also need to go through the access point and onto the normal network. Okay, this also acts as a media converter, which grabs the frames from the wired network. How do they articulate this here? Yeah, accepting the Ethernet frames from the wired network, converting them to 802.11 standards for the wireless. The access point will also accept 802.11 standard frames from the wireless network and convert them to Ethernet frames for the wired network. Okay, now APs are access points, which is built into everyone's integrated services routers here, will support wireless frames or wireless access within a limited area, known as a cell, or known as a basic service set or BSS. Basic service set or BSS. You'll probably see that when you're configuring your wireless router. You'll see BSS or something. You'll see that this is a basic service set. Okay, there's a device known as a wireless bridge, which is used to connect two wired networks through a wireless link. Okay, so that we might say that between two buildings, for example. This allows long-range point-to-point connections between different networks. Okay, it says here, using the unlicensed frequencies of the RF spectrum, networks at 25 miles or 40 kilometres can be connected. Okay, maybe a good idea is campuses between university buildings for you there, Marshall. Antennas. Yep, did you want to say something?
Nope, I was going to say I think we don't use any of that. I think all of our buildings are linked by cable.
Sure. Okay, antennas are obviously used on wireless bridges and wireless access points. It increases the access signal strength from a wireless device and receives wireless signals from other wireless devices such as stations or STAS. Now, all antennas, regardless of what they are, actually have a gain in them. Did you know that? Especially your 5/8 type antennas and stuff. They also have various patterns of radiation. I won't get too much into the old radio theory here, but they always have a bit of gain. Which is useful. Also, some of them can be directional. Okay, high gains usually transmit into increased distance, translate into increased distances. So you might put two watts into an antenna and get an effective radiated output of, say, 4 watts or something, depending on the gain of your antenna. So, effective radiated power was often different from wattages. And then you had losses on the line anyway, so it was always a bit of fun playing around with the maths back in the radio days. Okay, antennas are classified to the way they radiate the signal. This is important, and I think there's some test alerts here too. Okay, there are such things as directional antennas, which of course is pretty obvious. They concentrate the signal into a single direction. They also only receive from a single direction too. Most TV antennas here in Melbourne, and I think in different parts of the world, are directional antennas and are usually pointed at the terrestrial television transmitters. They concentrate the signal strength into one direction, is what it says. And the other type of category is known as an omnidirectional antenna, which designed to emit equally in all directions. Okay, so that's your two types of antennas, directional antennas and omnidirectional antennas. Now, with the directional antenna, or some people used to say a beam or a Yagi, back in our misspent youth days, they actually concentrate all the signal into one direction. So in actual fact, you get quite a lot of gain in one direction. It's all the signals being thrown out in one direction, so you get a really, really good, concentrated, strong, healthy signal. And obviously anything anything to the side of the antenna, for example, is very, very much attenuated. Directional antennas in the context here of networking are usually used in bridging. So bridging applications, for example, like between the two buildings, for example, let's put up a directional antenna because we know the buildings are static, they're not going to move. This, of course, they're in Wellington. I probably shouldn't have said that. But they're not going to move, so you're going to have, you won't want an omnidirectional antenna there. You're going to want to sort of send the signal directly from one antenna to another. Whereas an omnidirectional antenna, for example, is actually antennas you find on your APs, your access points and stuff around the small office, home office environment. Ah, SSIDs. Before we move to that, any questions about our antennas? How are you coping out there, Terry, being a visitor to us?
Yeah, surviving. Yep. It's all, some of this is, I've sort of done it before, but it's going into more detail, so that's cool.
Yeah, it is good. I like this chat. I've always liked this chat. It's good fun, isn't it? All right, so 7.2.3, WLANs and SSIDs. Listen up, gang. This is good. It is important when you're building a wireless network that all components can connect. I have a feeling Gypsy wants feeding. They connect together. And they all have to belong to the same SSID, or what's called a server set identifier. Can anyone give us an example of a server set identifier?
The name of your wireless network, like, you know, Home or Apple or whatever. Whatever you happen to call it.
That's it. Yeah, in my case, Lonsdale 4, because I've got my router that I've still left set to Lonsdale 2 in case I need to bring it back. So you can tell I've now had four boxes in here with different wireless networks in the 6 years I've been here. Yeah, exactly. So, Kim's is now called Amethyst Star, I think, or something very similar. And Star Amethyst or something. And, a lot of people don't configure these, and hackers actually get to learn them. Like, there's a number of Belkin ones I've seen around the suburbs and that sort of stuff. Anyway, this is a case-sensitive... Cisco defines it as a case-sensitive string up, an alphanumeric string up to 32 characters, which is, it said, is the name of our network. And this SSID is sent in the header of all frames transmitted over the WLAN. So there you go. So if this is how, one of the reasons how that Kim's computers know to talk to, is it Amethyst Star or Star Amethyst, huh?
It's Amethyst Star.
Yeah, so it's we expect to see that, all the computers that are on your network expect to see that in all the frames transmitted to and from that network. So that way, people participating in your access point must be using that SSID or server set identifier. So if you get a guest coming over, like your dad brings his laptop over, give him your key and tell him to look for Amethyst Star and you can have it happen. Basically it just says it's used to tell the wireless devices who to communicate with. Huh. Okay, so basically regardless of the device on your WLAN, all devices have to be configured with the server set identifier or name as Terry said before, in order for it to participate in the access point. No name, no talkies. Okay, there are two basic ways of setting up a WLAN, ad hoc and infrastructure mode. Now, we're all used to infrastructure mode here, but I guess it's going to talk about ad hoc first. Yes, it is. And then we'll come back to infrastructure mode, which is really what we're all using here on our networks around the class. The simplest form of a wireless network is an ad hoc network. It doesn't include a wireless access point or an AP. It's just basically two or more wireless connected devices in a peer-to-peer fashion. Yep, so there you go. It's back to your peer-to-peer stuff that we learned about several weeks ago. So that's an ad hoc network. All clients in an ad hoc or peer-to-peer network are equal. And the area covered by this network is known as an independent basic server set or IBSSS. IBSS, I beg your pardon, so an independent basic service set. A simple ad hoc network can be used to exchange files and that sort of stuff. Okay, understanding, gang, any problems with this? Okay, infrastructure mode. And though an ad hoc arrangement might be okay for some smaller networks, for larger networks, an infrastructure network is more suitable. When an access point is present, it takes over all of the communications. It will take over the role of deciding who can talk and when. Okay. Now, this is important because remember back in the Chapter 3 type period of this class, we talked about collisions and collision domains, and we had to, you know, back off algorithms and all that sort of stuff. We don't want collisions on our wireless network because it's going to degradate the communications, so the access point takes over the control of who can talk and when. This is known as infrastructure mode and is the most widely used form of wireless communications used in the home and small business. So, as I said before, everything's going through the AP, in and out, from computer to computer or host to host on the network. In this form of infrastructure mode, the computers cannot talk directly to each other. to communicate each of the devices. Let's say Shannon and Kim are transferring files because they're in the same room. They must obtain permission from the AP before this transmission can occur. The AP controls all communications and ensures that all stars have equal access to the medium. The area controlled or covered by a single wireless access point, or AP, is known as a BSS, and it is the basic service set and known as the smallest building block of a WLAN. The area of coverage by a single AP is limited. To expand the coverage area of a wireless network, it is possible to combine several BSSs, or basic service sets. It's known as a DS, or distribution system. It's something I've never played with in reality, but anyway, it does discuss it here in the notes. This forms an extended service set. We love our SSs, don't we? An extended service set, or ESS. And these ESSs are extended service sets used multiple APSs, or APs, or access points. Each AP is in a single BSS. That's a lot of bloody BSS, if you ask me. No, I shouldn't say that. Each AP is in its individual, is in a separate BSS, as I just said, on basic service set. In order to allow movement between the cells, each BSS, or basic service set, must actually overlap by about 10%. And I think this was in the exam. So if we're having a wireless network with multiple access points and multiple BSSs, for example, they have to overlap by about 10% in order to get communications between each part of it. This allows for the client to connect from to a second AP before disconnecting from the first. Most home and small business environments consist of only a single BSS. Okay. However, as you know, it becomes necessary, like maybe in a big building or factory, it becomes necessary to set up multiple BSSs and have an ESS, or an extended service set. How are we going, guys? So far, got you annoyed with all the BSSs? All right, 19 minutes past the hour. Let's get a move on. Wireless channels. I actually set my wireless up on a different channel to stop it from interfering with the lady next door when she moved in. And I got all my coverage back, and everything started happening nice and fast, as Kim remembers. Now, one way this business of messing around with IBSSs and stuff, BSSs and ESSs, is through the use of channels. Channels are created by dividing up the available RF spectrum. Now, let's have a think about this from our television station days. In Melbourne, we have channel 2, channel 7, channel 9, and channel 10, 28, and 30. Something rather, 35 or something, 31 I think it is, as our four or five main terrestrial channels. We now have a lot more on the digital network, which is actually transmitted over the top. So each of these channels have multiple transmissions, but we're not going to go there. So we say, like a radio station, a channelized 10 or 9 kilohertz AM receiver, for example, or FM receiver, each station transmits on a different channel, or different frequency, so that whilst they're AM band has multiple stations in it, they're not all transmitting on the one frequency, or they'd be heterodyning and transmitting over the top of one another. So the same thing happens here with our ISS or IBSSs and etc. So we have different channels, and that's how I was able to tell mine. Just use one of the channels up the far end of the band, channel 10 I think I set mine to, and steer away from the auto setting that that the router was using and that the stations were using, which happened to be probably very similar to what the lady next door, who wouldn't have the knowledge I've got, would be using. So, yep, once I confined mine to a single channel, I was happy. That's the same as the reason why channel 9 doesn't interfere with channel 10. Okay. Multiple APSs can actually function in close proximity to one another. And it says here, unfortunately, it is possible for the frequencies by one channel to overlap and it cause interference to that of an adjacent channel, which is why I picked a channel right up the far end. Different conversations must be carried on non-overlapping channels. The number and distribution of channels vary on region and technologies. I think in some countries they only allow you to use one. In Australia, that's, I think, about 13 of them here. We're talking back on our wireless lands now. I think there's 13 odd channels allocated. Kerry seems to know them all. Yeah, it says a selection of channel can be set either automatically or manually. Well, I've just said I've set mine manually, of course. Normally, each wireless conversation makes use of a separate channel. Some of the combination neural technologies combine the channels to make a single wide channel, which then effectively gives you more bandwidth. Within a WLAN, and the lack of well-defined boundaries make it hard to detect, make it impossible to detect if collisions occur during transmission. So here we go. We've got no way of telling if a collision will occur, but we can avoid it. Therefore, it is important to use an access method on a wireless LAN that ensures collisions do not occur in the first place. Remember, we use CSMA slash CD on the Ethernet network. Remember that with which was carrier sense multiple access collision detection. Remember where all that back in chapter 3, gang? I'm sure you do, Narissa.
No, I don't. I don't remember that acronym.
Well, good to think to forget. We remember we were talking about, you know, the higher voltage on the wire, and we were detecting with the back off algorithm on the network interface card if two stations transmitted at the same time. Oh, this is scary. Well, just keep all that in mind for your final exam, gang, because that wasn't important. We don't want collisions.
That at all in, well, I mean, between I remember network collisions, segment? But not this other thing you're talking about.
Oh, the CSMA slash CD. Well, in wireless, we have CSMA slash CA, which is carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance, because we've got no way of sensing if the collisions of packets occur on the wireless network here, so it's better to avoid them in the first place. Now, in Ethernet, we had collision detection, so if two stations transmitted and, you know, put a garbled signal on the network segment, a back-off algorithm would be sent and the cards would, you know, the stations would back off and then they would start talking again. Yeah, we did cover it. I would suggest having a listen to Chapter 3 before you sit your finals, gang, because I know that was one of the heavier chapters. In wireless, we have the collision avoidance, CSMA slash CA, which is multiple sense carrier. God, it's hard. I'm getting my mind mixed up now. Carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance. Because again, if we have a collision on the wireless access point or on the same group of wireless access clients, then it's going to be garbled and no one's going to understand the information coming through. Okay, CSMA slash CA can provides what's known as a reservation on a channel for use by a specific combination. While a reservation is in place, no other device may transmit on the channel. So let's have Kim and Shannon again, for example. They're communicating and sending a file. If my computer piped up on the same channel, well, it wouldn't be allowed to if I turned up and my computer got on the same channel and wanted to, you know, go over the top. It wouldn't happen. That's why everything's controlled by the wireless access point. Is this making sense, Kimmy?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So no one can barge in on your conversation, sort of. How does the reservation process work? Okay, if a device requires specific use of a channel in the BSS, it must ask for permission from the access point, or AP. This is known as a request to send RTS. If the channel is available, the AP will respond with a request to send, I think it's called. Clear to send, sorry, which is a CTS, indicating that the channel is free. So if your computer wants to use that channel, it gets permission and it comes back with a CTS, which is a clear to send, and away you go. A bit like an airline pilot asking for permission to land. You have clearance to land. A CTS can be broadcast to all devices within a BSS. Therefore, all devices in a channel know that all devices in a basic service set know that a particular channel is in use. Once the conversation is complete, the device that requested the channel sends. The device that receives, I think it is, known as an acknowledgement. In other words, who sends the acknowledgement here? I'm getting confused. Once the conversation is complete, the device that requested the channel, let's say Kim's computer requested the channel, will send another message to the AP, known as an acknowledgement or ACK to the access point. Okay, it basically indicates the channel can be released. Now, I'm going to need to get a bit further into this because we haven't even talked about methods of authentication yet. I've been mucking around too much with RF stuff, but I think it's important. Once the choice of wireless access standard has been made, it is time to configure the AP. And there's an exercise here in Chapter 7 that can do that. Kim's already done it. Basic configuration settings such as passwords, setting the SSID and the key, etc. are put in. The default password should be changed before the AP is connected to the network. The reason for this is because hackers often know them, like Cisco or the Linksys routers often have admin and admin, or admin and password, admin being the username, password being the password as the password to get into it. So if somebody coming down your driveway wanted to log on your network and get free internet, they could. Oh, they could actually reconfigure your router and lock you out, so you don't want that going on. Wireless mode. Well, most of these devices can support the 802.11b GNA. Yeah, we've been through that. The type of mode enabled on the AP often depends on the type of host connecting to it. I've got mine running in mixed mode GNN because there is still one computer in the house and the tuner out in the living room that only uses G. And the same for the encryption standard too. When we get to that, I couldn't put all the encryption on it I want because the old laptop didn't support it. Now, you can enable mixed mode, which I've done, which is N and G, and network performance will decrease if you do. So if I only had all N devices, like a friend of mine does, Craig actually just puts it on N, I think, and that's it, and he's done with it because that's all he's got. The SSID, which is used to identify the network, as Terry mentioned before. All devices that wish to participate need to use it. We said that before. Now, you can broadcast this SSID, which I do because I have clients who want to just go to available networks in their Windows and look for Lonsdale 4, press enter, and be asked to type in the key, and away they go. You can actually disable it, and that is actually a security step if you want to not completely block but make it harder for people to get into your wireless access point, because there are people who often drive around the cities looking for open ones, and that's one of the reasons they find them is because they're broadcasting. If the SSID, like in my case Lonsdale 4, is not broadcast, the wireless clients will need to actually have this value put in manually, and I had to do that last year at a friend's place, is just type in the name of their network and get access to it that way, because he told me what it was. Craig told me what the name of his network was. Wireless channels, the choice of channels, and Jason BSS must use non-overlapping channels. I'm going to skip through some of this and you can read your notes. Configuring the wireless client, there is a worksheet on this. A wireless host or star is defined as any wireless device that can participate in the that contains a wireless network interface card or a wireless NIC, and then that can participate in the network. It usually has client software on it. Windows, most operating systems these days have the client software built in, but you can get third-party client software if you want, and particularly for those people running USB wireless cards. Devices that are STs can include PDAs, laptops, desktop PCs, printers, projectors, and Wi-Fi phones. And I would include my tuner in amongst all that too out in the living room. The client configuration must match that of the AP for it to connect. The SSID has to match the security settings and channel information if the channel was manually set. Okay. The Windows XP client software is an example of software that's built into an operating system that will allow it to connect to a WLAN. It's basic management software that can control configuration and that sort of stuff. It is user-friendly and offers a simple way of connecting. There are standalone wireless utility software that you can get. These pieces of software are often supplied with the wireless NIC and designed to operate with that specific card or device. It usually offers enhanced functionality over and above that of what you find in Windows XP or probably even now Windows 7, etc. Some of the information you can get out of this type of software is the signal strength. With the proprietary software that comes with your card, if you're not using the Windows one, you can actually set up profiles. I've seen that done on the IBMs and Lenovos. There's a site survey often feature that enables the detection of all wireless networks in the vicinity of where you are. It is not possible to allow both wireless utilities to run. So if you are going to use the proprietary one that comes with your card, you would want to, you would have to disable the Windows XP one. Once the client software is configured, verify your link. Yep. You might want to look at your connection data rate, connection status, whether it's actually logged on properly, and wireless channel used. You won't get an IP address if you're not logged on your network, so you can often just use IP config if you want a simple way of seeing if your network, your wireless network's up. Okay, I'll get you to read your notes. I'm just going to skip because I'm getting a bit wary of time. 35 minutes past the hour. We're now at 7.3. The security considerations on a wireless LAN, guys. Unfortunately, one of the disadvantages of wireless technology is that hackers or people causing a threat to you do not have to be physically connected to your network. The ease of connectivity of wireless networks makes this so, of course. It is possible for an attacker to tune into signals and can access your network from just sitting at the front of your house. Once they have access to your network, and if you've got internet services on that network, which most of us do, they can use your internet for free. Yep, free internet for all. And I know somebody who got into a wireless LAN one day and set the SSID up for that. Free internet for all, because it was unsecured. Naughty, naughty. They can also see your private information. You know, if you've got no security on a directory you've shared out, they can go walking around your computer, and worms and viruses can definitely get into your computer that way. So you really want to have security. And you don't want people downloading, you know, sitting there at the front torrenting, you know, heaps of, you know, movies down because you're paying for the internet. War driving is the technique of driving around the suburbs looking for such open networks that haven't got security on them. Once they're discovered, the WLANs that are not secured are kept in a list somewhere, and hackers like it. The goal of war driving is to bring attention to the fact that most wireless networks are insecure. Well, more and more of the ones I'm seeing, even your novice people coming out of the department stores are starting to secure them, because it's becoming pretty common now to have wireless networks. There's a similar process known as war walking, listed here in the notes. That's where you walk around the suburbs looking for open networks. Often, once access is discovered to a house with an open network or an establishment with an open network, people will put a chalk mark out the front of the place to let other people know that this is a place you can get free internet. One easy way is gaining access through the network name or SSID. And this is all repetitive stuff. All computers must know the SSID. We've been through this before. You can turn off the SSID, which is what my friend Craig does. It makes it somewhat easier to get into. But there are pieces of software out there that Kerry knows about that will allow you to connect, that will allow you to light up a hidden network. Did you disconnect, Kim? No, somebody disconnected.
No,
you're right, honey. No, somebody disconnected. Terry might have gone. Oh, sorry, Terry. Maybe she had to go to the foundry or something. Who knows? Okay, I'm going to skip a lot of this. Basically, what it's saying is, if you want to infiltrate a network and you know the defaults, like Cisco use Cisco or Linksys, and Balcon use Balcon. I've got no idea what mine was because it got changed as soon as I turned it on. Change these defaults. Change your username. Change the username of the network, of the device, so you can't log into it. Some of them will actually allow you to turn off logging into it and controlling it from the wireless part of the device. My old Linksys used to do that. So if you wanted to control the router, you couldn't log into it across the wireless network. You just got a, you know, page cannot be displayed in your web browser. So you can only connect to it if you're on the Ethernet. You could use it, it would work, but you couldn't configure it unless you were on the wired part. That was another security consideration, but you could use it, obviously. Change your SSID. Don't leave the default there. Change the default admin and username, admin password and username that comes with it out of the box. Another way of security is you can do MAC address filtering. You can actually make the access point, and I know the Linksys routers support this, and there's an exercise there, I think, where you can actually only make it talk to computers with known MAC addresses, because even your wireless network interface card has a MAC address similar to that of our layer 2 hardware address as your normal network interface card. So if the MAC address is not known in the MAC address table, it won't let you connect. When a wireless device wishes to connect with an AP, it will send MAC address information, and if MAC filtering is enabled, the device will only, the AP will only let you connect if it knows your MAC addresses has been pre-configured. There are some issues with this type of security, of course. Basically, the MAC address of all the devices have to be pre-configured or included in the database before they attempt to connect. A device that's not identified in the database obviously won't be able to connect. And additionally, although this is very rare, it is possible for the device of another device to clone the MAC address and pretend to be that, and some of the more advanced hackers would know how to do that, and therefore send incorrect MAC address information to the access point and tricking it into allowing it to connect. Another way of controlling security, of course, is authentication. Remember how we discussed before that all the network traffic has to be, I guess you could say, moderated by the access point? Well, it's because they know who the stations are, of course, and you have to authenticate, or to implement authentication. Authentication is the process of permitting entry into a network by, based on a set of credentials, a username, password or something. It is used to verify that the device connecting to a network is trusted, and the username and password is the most form of authentication with just about anything that we use these days, even logging onto websites. Okay, authentication, if enabled, must occur before the client is allowed to connect to the WLAN. And there are three types of wireless authentication, and this is different from encryption, I might add. Open authentication, PSK, and EAP. Now, EAP, I think, is the Cisco one. PSK is what I've enabled here. Open authentication. By default, wireless devices do not require authentication. Any and all clients can associate regardless of who they are. This is open authentication. And this should only, this type of authentication only be used on, should only be used on open networks such as schools and restaurants and public places. It can also be used on networks once authentication is done by other means. And a good example of this is when I was sitting at Los Angeles International Airport. They allowed access to the network by anybody. Anyone could get on it, but in order to see the internet, you had to go through, you put up a page whenever you typed in any web address, even my own Lonsdale Media type ones. It put up a web page asking me to pay $7 for a day pass, so I did. And then what it would do is probably log my MAC address. I'm not sure how it actually worked. I never got time to figure that out, but I assume it just, it obviously knew my triple EPC probably by means of the MAC address. So yeah, when I logged off after dinner and came back on after my MAC is at the airport while I was waiting for the flight home to Sydney, I was able to get back on and keep messing around on the internet. The hotel when we were at the Grand Canyon did a similar thing, although they didn't require payment, but they required us to look at their web page and tick the box to say that we had agreeing to their terms and conditions. So that was open authentication for that part of the network, but still to get the actual internet fed through, we had to agree for the their terms and conditions. So that was another way of authenticating at a different layer. It says it can, open authentication can be used on networks where authentication is given by another means, which is in the case of LAX and the Grand Canyon night. Pre-shared keys, PSK. Both the AP and the client must be configured with the same key. The AP sends a random string of clients to the client. The client accepts the string encrypts it or scrambles it based on the key, actually, and then sends it back to the AP. The AP gets the key and uses it to decrypt or unscramble information. If the string received from the client matches the original string sent to the client, the client is allowed to connect to the system, to the network. Now I've just lost my place here. Now EAP, which is mutual or two-way, which is the extensible authentication protocol. I think that's the one that Cisco really wants to promote. It contains mutual or two-way communication as well as user authentication. When EAP, this is a little bit advanced here, but when EAP software is installed, the client communicates with a back-end authentication system or a RADIUS server to get access. RADIUS or this separate server functions independently of the AP and has its own database of authenticated users. In other words, when using EAP, the user, not just the host, so in other words, when using EAP, the user, in other words, the person sitting at the keyboard, must provide a username and password which is checked against the RADIUS database for validity. So basically, you'll get a prompt to log onto the network. And if it's valid, you'll be authenticated. So that's two methods of logging on there, two methods of authenticating: the PSK, pre-shared keys, done sort of behind the scenes for you, and the one where you need user interface, interaction with it. Okay, once authentication has happened, basically everything connects. Now, if MAC filtering is used, authentication occurs first, evidently. So there you go. I've never done a system with both on it, but there you go. All right, so there you go. Encryption on a WLAN. Authentication and filtering may stop a hacker from connecting. Since there are no distinct boundaries and all traffic is transmitted wirelessly, it's easy for an attacker to sniff it out because there's no distinct boundaries. They can sniff out your frames. So basically it's saying that encryption is the process of transforming data, so even if data is intercepted, it is unusable. So a hacker might be able to intercept the data, but they can't use it. Wide equivalency protocol, I'm moving a bit fast here. WEP, that got hacked a long time ago and no one now ever uses it, basically. It's called wide equivalency protocol, so it was meant to be as equivalent to connecting up with a wire, but it got hacked very quickly. It uses a pre-configured key system to encrypt the data. A WEP key is a string of data and is usually numbers and letters, is usually around about 64 to 128 bits long. In some cases, WEP can support 256 bits in their key. To simplify entering these keys, many devices use a passphrase option that you can just, it converts it for you. And the passphrase is something that you can easily remember. In order for all the devices to function, they must use the correct WEP key. And without this key entered in, the wireless device will not be able to understand the wireless transmissions coming from the AP. WEP is a good way of preventing hackers. Well, it was until it got hacked, I guess. One of the weaknesses, of course, is that it uses a static key, so the key is the same and it doesn't change in WEP. And I think this is in the test, and it actually does say here in the notes there are applications available to hackers that allow them to discover the WEP key. So there you go. Once they've got it, they've got access to your network. and these applications are readily available on the internet. Once the hacker has extracted the key, they've got complete access. Okay. There's another way of using which is called WPA, or Wi-Fi Protected Access. This is a little bit more advanced than WEP. Now, it also uses an encryption key from 64 to 256 bits. However, the main difference between WEP and WPA is it generates dynamic keys, so they're always changing. So every time a client establishes connection with the AP, it establishes a new key, so therefore Mr. Hacker can't keep up with it so easily. So for this reason, WPA is considered more secure. Traffic filtering. 10 minutes to go, gang, and we've got to run through. There is traffic filtering. I would ask you to read your notes. You can probably filter out undesirable traffic like certain websites. It can be used to remove traffic to and from a distant host, and there is an exercise there in the worksheets that I never carried it out, but Jackie insisted some of the students did. I'm always a bit anxious about getting people to carry out stuff on their only integrated services router, but you can block certain websites, I think, on the router that they use in the worksheets. Configuring an integrated AP and wireless client, this is also a worksheet that you need to do. It's basically important to plan before doing an installation. Some of the things you need to do are determine the standard you want to use. I chose N. I also chose PSK when I set mine up. Determining the most efficient layout of devices. I'll make this quick. As I said to you right back at the beginning of the lesson, you want to make sure your access point is in a pretty clear and easy to get to place around the house. Usually a central point in the house is a good place. If you put up one end of the house, you may have difficulty down the other end of the house, particularly if you have concrete walls or something. Installation security plan. So think about the password I've got for mine, for example, or the keys for mine is something I don't use anywhere else. That way, when I get a client who comes in, if I tell them the key, it's a key that's easy to remember, hard to crack, but easy to remember. It's based on a slight formula I've got and is not something I use anywhere else. Consider your standards. Bandwidth requirements, coverage area, existing implementations, and cost, of course, are things you have to consider. This information is gathered by determining end-user requirements. So if you're setting this up for a friend or a client, you need to be good at asking them the right questions so that you can get sort of an idea of what they want from their network. Ask questions. What's required? How many users will access the WLAN? What's the necessary coverage area? What is the existing network, if any, structure? And what's your budget? Yeah, no doubt they're all going to say, oh, can I have it for free? No, you can't. Remember, the bandwidth must be shared between all of the users in the same BSS, or basic service set. Okay, even if each host or each connection doesn't require a high bandwidth or high speed, that bandwidth or speed should be available so you can handle multiple users on the same channel, or multiple users on the same BSS rather. So think about that. Different standards support different coverage areas. I've already outlined them. Refer to your notes because there are test questions. Thus, 211.G, B, G, and N supports a larger basic service set of BSS. This transmits into the larger the BSS translates into less equipment and therefore lower costs. So remember how we talked about our multiple networks overlaying each other before in different BSSs. If you have a larger BSS, you'll have less costs if you need to do an overlap situation. Okay. Remember the standards that are backward compatible with each other. The existing N standard is backward compatible with all of them now. G is only backward compatible with B. Okay. Consider your total cost of ownership. We've seen this occur in other parts of the Cisco curriculum. Total cost of ownership can be also applied to printers for those people who have just done ITE Chapter 7. In a larger environment, TCO, total cost of ownership, obviously has a larger impact. Installation of wireless devices for home and small businesses. Stuff can be easily relocated to give you optimum throughput. Well, I don't know about that. In the enterprise environment, equipment cannot be so easily relocated. So it is important to determine the optimum location of your devices. You can do this by means of what's known as a site survey. And the person doing the site survey must be knowledgeable in WLAN devices. All right, this can be an extensive process, so be careful, gang. Installing and securing the AP 7.4.2, read this bit. Security measures should also be planned before implementation. Change default values for the SSID, like the usernames and passwords. Change the SSID itself. And also, if you want, configure MAC address filtering. You don't necessarily have to these days. Well, a lot of people don't, but some do. Some of the more advanced security measures above those three steps I've just given you are obviously WPA or WEP, preferably WPA, configure authentication, and configure traffic filtering. Keep in mind that no single security measure will keep your wireless network completely free of attacks. Combining multiple techniques, such as the ones I've listed above, will increase your probability of a secure network. Remember, when configuring your SSID, it must match on the AP and the clients. Go ahead, whoever wanted to mic up.
Yeah, don't they have a WPA2 now?
WPA2 they do, actually. Yeah, yeah, it should have been mentioned here. Not sure offhand exactly the benefits. Oh, it's a little bit more secure. Carried, no.
I think they cracked WPA.
I think they have too, actually, come to think of it. Yes, I think you're right. So actually, mine does WPA too. You'll often see it there. Okay, once the WPA is configured, a full backup of the settings should be done. I haven't even checked on Kim's router to see if that can be done. Actually, I did have mine backed up somewhere. You can, with the Linksys ones anyway, save the configuration out to a, I think it's a binary file. And what then happens is that you can go and you can reload that configuration and usually through its web interface, the same configuration, and your router will come back as it was prior to you doing the backup. So I did that with my friend Amy's, actually. I was troubleshooting it, and I happened to, she bought the same router as I did back in the Linksys, when I still had the Linksys before the lightning strike. And I was troubleshooting it because, among other things, it wouldn't get on the network, it wouldn't log on to her ADSL provider. We later on found that that was actually an unfiltered phone up the other end of the house. But while I was in the troubleshooting process, I thought, well, maybe this device is cactus. Maybe it's buggered. It doesn't work. So I put my configuration in it, and up she didn't come because it was at that time not known to me. It wasn't until we went out to dinner that Amy goes, oh, I've got this other phone down the other end of the house, and it hasn't got a filter. And I said, bingo. You could have told me that before we stressed out over it. So we went back home after dinner and fixed it up, and up she came, went like a man thing. But to all intents and purposes, if you go to Amy's place now with my laptop, it will think it's logging onto one of my old networks because it's got my configuration in it. So it's a good way if you have to configure multiple devices, I guess. It's a backup configuration and restore. So I think there is an exercise in the worksheet on that for memory. I remember it there somewhere. Updating firmware, there may also be an exercise there, I'm not sure, but you can update the firmware of the software that's housed on the device. Often this is a recommended step to do. Kim will remember that one of our clients, Ross, was advised to do that when he was having internet connectivity. Remember that the other week, hun?
Yeah, I remember that. It was interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting, some of the problems Ross was having until he went off and did all that. Now, be careful when you're updating the firmware. Again, it's done through the web interface of the device. Careful when you're updating your firmware. Don't switch off the device until it switches itself off or you're told to do so. Or you could render the device inoperable. And the technical term of that is called bricking your device. You don't want to turn it into a brick. So follow the instructions carefully when you are updating firmware. And that doesn't just apply to ISRs, integrated services routers, but digital cameras, iRivers, anything that you update the firmware on. Determine the version of firmware that's currently installed on the device and see if your new version is newer and better. Often this configuration is displayed on the configuration screen. One of the first things I did with my one I got, because the one I'm using uses an open source firmware done by a project. I've got the Asus one, and it one of the first things we did is to update the firmware, and it also changed very, very dramatically the web interface, made it somewhat more accessible and a hell of a lot more configurable. And every now and again Craig will do me a new version of the firmware, and I'll put in as he suggests. The good thing about this particular one, often when you update the firmware on this, it doesn't actually mess up your settings, which is rather cool. Because remember, settings and firmware is different. Okay, it tells you to download the updated version of the firmware and put it on your hard drive and then use the steps provided to install it. Chapter summary. We are at 9 o'clock Melbourne time. Any questions before I go quickly into the summary? I won't do the quiz because we're now up at time to go. No questions. All right. So in this chapter, we learnt various technologies for the transmission of information, various technologies available for transmitting information between hosts with no cables. It advises the benefits and limitations of wireless technologies. It told us that wireless technologies uses the electromagnetic spectrum. It told us that the most common ways for wireless technologies in the context of computing is infrared and wireless communications, usually the ISM band. Remote control wireless mice and keyboards often use infrared. We also should know that devices like microwave ovens and cordless phones, I think I did mention my cordless phone, can often interfere with wireless devices. Wireless devices can be grouped into three major categories. Wireless personal area networks, WPANs, wireless local area networks, WLANs, and WWANs, or wireless wide area networks. The standards that govern them are all the 802.11 standards, which I don't need to go on about because I already have. Devices in a WLAN have to include the clients, access points, wireless bridges, and antennas. A small wireless peer-to-peer network is known as an ad hoc network. It doesn't include an access point or AP, but when an access point or AP is present, it's known as an infrastructure network, infrastructure mode. There's two types of antennas, omnidirectional and directional. And all wireless devices in a WLAN have to be configured with the same SSID. And really, guys, we're at 9 o'clock. There are security measures I would encourage you to read. And here endeth the lecture. Well done, gang, for putting up with me for 2 hours.
Have a good evening, everybody. I'm off to give blood.
Oh, you noble person. Painful. Yes, I haven't done that for a while. Sorry, Kim.
I just said, ouch, painful.
Yeah, it is a bit. I'll come up on Skype if you want to talk after this. I just want a quick chat before you have dinner. Did you get your pasta made?
No, getting too hungry. I'm making chicken instead.
Ah.
Okay, I'll right, say Narissa. Bye, guys.
All right, we'll see you during the week. And I'm not even sure whether Pat, I think Terry disappeared. Pat's still there. All right, guys, thanks for putting up with us. We've got two more meetings to go, and that's it. So enjoy.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.